We've never seen a delegation this young and also this engaged to showing up to a state convention before.
Young Democrats flocked to the state convention in Anchorage. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, May 13th. Good evening, I'm Rachel Waldholz. Also tonight, ExxonMobil prepares for the next step.
10,000 barrels per day is not the end game. That's not the end game. Point Thompson is a pre-investment for what's to come.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
And by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
The Alaska Senate voted 14-5 today to approve a sweeping overhaul of the state's criminal justice system. The action sends the bill to Governor Bill Walker for his signature. Senate Bill 91 would allow some low-risk nonviolent offenders to avoid jail time. It would also establish a new pretrial services program with a goal of reducing recidivism. And it would allow those in treatment programs to receive credit for time served instead of imprisonment. Bill sponsor John Coghill, a North Pole Republican, says the bill was driven by a consensus among members of the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission and draws on social science research. Walker says he's eager to review the bill. Alaska Democrats are hosting their state convention today through Sunday in Anchorage. More than 500 party members from across the state are attending, and the event culminates in the selection of delegates to attend the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia this July. Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes is covering the convention. Hi, Zach.
Hi, Rachel. How are you?
Good. And Zach, just spell out for us, what are we expecting this weekend?
Good question. A couple of things that we're expecting. One is all the kind of housekeeping that the Alaska Democratic Party needs to take care of in a year. So that means selecting, representatives from different regions to kind of come together and represent the party. It means agenda setting. It means just kind of checking in and seeing what needs to be taken care of. And the second part, and I think the part that maybe this year is a little bit more exciting than most, is that we still don't have a Democratic nominee for president. So the delegates who are going to be going to the Democratic National Convention in July are going to get selected this weekend. And that's hugely important for people that still feel like they have a dog in the fight over who's going to be the Democratic presidential nominee.
And Alaska Democrats in their primary this spring, they went pretty heavily for Bernie Sanders. So does that mean that Alaska is sending an all-Bernie delegation to the national convention?
Not quite. It's proportionate. So Sanders got about 81% of the votes in the caucus. There'll be 13 delegates sent to kind of caucus for Bernie or represent the Bernie Sanders campaign in Philly, 3 for Hillary Clinton, 4 more that are, so-called superdelegates who represent kind of people that have spent a long time within the Democratic Party, and then 2 alternates. And what's going to happen on Saturday is that who those actual people are is going to be determined, which for stakeholders in the party is a pretty big deal.
Great. Well, thanks a ton, Zach.
Thank you, Rachel.
That's Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes, who will be attending the Democratic Convention this weekend. Organizers of the Democratic Convention say young voters have turned out in record numbers, driven by Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders' bid for the presidency. One Juneau teen and college student is rushing headlong into her first national election, securing a spot as a state delegate to support a candidate she's hoping will change the country's political process. KTOO's Rasha McChesney has more.
India Busby is new to politics, passionate about voting, and feeling the burn. While it's the first national election for the 19-year-old Juneau college student, she finagled her way into being one of 539 delegates for Alaska's Democratic Convention in Anchorage.
I'm very excited. I'm a little nervous, but we'll see how it goes.
Because it's her first time attending a convention, Busby isn't sure what to expect, but she's looking forward to some of the workshops offered over the weekend.
There is one about the expansion of Medicaid. There's one about the legalization of marijuana and what we're gonna do with it. And then there's this one about running for office, which I'm really interested in.
Busby will join hordes of other Bernie Sanders supporters who voted during the March caucuses. More than 10,600 Democrats turned out in Alaska and handed the Vermont senator nearly 80% of the votes. She says she picked Sanders because he supports issues she cares about, like education and healthcare reform. Jake Hamburg, the communications director of the Alaska Democratic Party, doesn't know how many teens are headed to the state convention, but he isn't surprised to hear about Busby's trip.
We don't identify delegates by age, but in talking with other folks that have been around for a while, we've never seen a delegation this young and also this engaged to showing up to a state convention before. So it is really exciting to see.
Busby didn't apply for a spot as a national delegate, in part because she doesn't think she can afford it. She's already spent $400 getting to the state convention, a small fortune for a college student. In Juneau, I'm Rasha McChesney.
As lawmakers continue to debate how to handle the state's budget gap, the University of Alaska is facing major cuts and a budget hole of its own that could add up to $75 million. University President Jim Johnson is pitching one potential plan, bringing the entire university system under a single accreditation rather than its current setup with three administratively separate campuses.
I think there's enough potential for increased collaboration across the campuses, and reduced administrative cost and more streamlined processes that I think it will be a net benefit for our students. Otherwise, I wouldn't be looking at it.
If the university pursues that route, Johnson says the day-to-day classroom life of students would be largely unchanged. What would change is the administrative structure of the system. Johnson says having four separate bureaucracies, one for each of the main campuses and the statewide entity, is excessive.
In order to serve our 30,000 students and then this, 700 or so thousand Alaskans in this tight financial time, we've got to be we've really got to scrutinize that administrative structure to make sure that every dollar possible is going into something that's academic and making a difference for our students.
Johnson estimates that savings would be somewhere in the $5 to $6 million range just from restructuring top-level administrators. Among the positions that could be cut, university chancellors. Johnson says that means the University of Alaska Fairbanks will not be appointing a permanent chancellor in the near term. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Alaskans are facing extreme wildfire danger this season.
My first thoughts when I saw Fort McMurray going up in flames, it just took me right back to Miller's Reach and the Sockeye Fire last year.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein. Attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by
ExxonMobil Alaska, working with more than 100 Alaska communities and thousands of Alaskans. Today, ExxonMobil is producing natural gas condensate from the Point Thompson facilities.
Governor Bill Walker said today that the state government must have a say in which oil and gas projects are eligible for tax incentives. Walker says he's concerned the oil and gas tax overhaul being debated by the House doesn't give the administration approval over incentives. He proposed adding that authority, but it wasn't included in the current version of the oil and gas tax bill.
It's one of those things that just, I think, got out of hand. And it was never intended to be, a $700 million, billion-dollar expenditure on something we have no say in. Can you imagine us giving, $700 million to any entity in Alaska and not have any say about what it is?
Walker also pushed back against a different legislative proposal to draw money from permanent fund earnings to cover the state's $4 billion deficit. Eagle River Republican Senator Anna McKinnon says she'd prefer the House approve drawing money from the Constitutional Budget Reserve, which requires three quarters of the House to agree. But McKinnon says drawing from permanent fund earnings is the legislature's last option if they can't come to an agreement. This would take only a bare majority of both houses.
The last option available to us, should the minority not come together and support the three-quarter vote draw that's necessary to access the Constitutional Budget Reserve, then the only option we have is to go after the earnings reserve to fund the budget.
Walker stopped short of saying he would veto a budget that draws on permanent fund earnings without a long-term fiscal plan, but he says he opposes that approach. The House was scheduled to begin debating amendments to the oil and gas tax bill, House Bill 247, today. 39 years after it was first discovered, ExxonMobil's Point Thompson field on the North Slope has started production. Point Thompson sits on the coast about 60 miles east of Prudhoe Bay, near the edge of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. When it's fully online, it'll send about 10,000 barrels a day of diesel-like oil down the Trans-Alaska pipeline. But Exxon sees the field as a down payment on a much larger prize, a North Slope gas line. Corey Quarles is new to Alaska. He only moved to Anchorage about a year ago to become ExxonMobil's new production manager in the state. But the project he's leading, that has history. Here's Quarles speaking to the Resource Development Council in early May.
And some of you may be wondering, okay, so ExxonMobil, what took you so long?
The Point Thompson field was first discovered in 1977. By 2006, Governor Frank Murkowski's administration was so frustrated by the lack of development, it tried to revoke the leases at the field, launching a seven-year legal battle. Three governors later, Sean Parnell approved the Point Thompson settlement in 2012, laying out a roadmap for development at the site. And this spring, after some 4 years and $4 billion, Exxon announced first production.
This is an extremely big deal, you know, for us.
That's Quarles speaking in his office on his fifth media interview to trumpet the new field. And the 10,000 barrels a day that the field will feed into the Trans-Alaska pipeline are certainly worth something, especially in this era of low throughput. But Quarles is clear, that is not the final goal.
10,000 barrels per day is not the end game. That's not the end game. Point Thompson is a pre-investment for what's to come.
What's to come, Exxon hopes, is an 800-mile pipeline carrying natural gas from the field to Cook Inlet for export to Asia, the Alaska LNG project. Because while Point Thompson is producing liquids right now, it's actually a gas field. And it's not just any gas field. It is a huge gas field. It holds about 1/4 of the known gas reserves on the North Slope.
So this is massive. You know, by all means, you know, this would be considered like a world-class type of field. So that's the prize. That's how big it is.
But right now, Point Thompson is a gas field without a gas line. Negotiations on the Alaska LNG project are stalled, held up by low oil prices and disagreements among Exxon and its partners, BP, ConocoPhillips, and of course, the state of Alaska. Under the current plan, the partners would make a final decision on the project by about 2019, though that now seems optimistic. But that might not matter to Exxon. Charles Ebinger is with the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. He says even if the gas line is delayed by a decade or more, it's probably still worth it.
These companies really do think in 20 and 30 year time horizons in terms of, you know, what's our energy portfolio going to look at. So it's not that far out on Exxon's time horizon.
The bottom line, he says, is Exxon clearly believes there will be a natural gas line from the North Slope at some point. In the meantime, the company is cycling the gas at Point Thompson. It pumps the gas out of the ground, strips out liquids to send down the Trans-Alaska pipeline, and then re-injects the gas into the reservoir. It's a basic process used at fields the world over, but with one crucial twist. Point Thompson is one of the highest pressure reservoirs Exxon has ever developed. One of the highest pressure fields in the world, Quarles says. He compares the force inside the reservoir to having the entire weight of an elephant balanced on your thumb. And that makes for a major engineering challenge.
You know, piping that's thicker than you've ever seen before. So, you know, the piping is 3 inches thick of steel. Steel.
One major goal of the gas cycling is just to learn how a field like this works. And Exxon is out to prove something else, too. The field opens up a new region of the North Slope, and Quarles says the company wants it to be a role model for future development.
There are no other fields that are producing this far east. And so what it does do is that it demonstrates oil and gas production can occur safely and responsibly, you know, even in a very remote area. And it has the potential to where you could potentially unlock even other fields that far east.
And what's east of Point Thompson? Ah, yes, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. The wildfire raging through subdivisions in Fort McMurray, Alberta last week generated horrifying images of burnt homes and evacuees. Firefighters say the fire season is already well underway in Alaska, too, and they need citizens to do their part to keep communities safe. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
The Fort McMurray fire started during a spell of unusually warm weather. Suddenly, an entire city of 80,000 was on the run, or, as shown on CTV, stuck in highway traffic jams.
It happened so fast, people were told to leave immediately. Late reports say many buildings are burning, whole neighborhoods have been destroyed, even the downtown core is on fire.
Matanuska-Susitna Emergency Services Director Bill Gamble was far from Alberta, but he says that fire hit close to home.
Absolutely, it can happen here. In fact, you know, my first thoughts when I saw Fort McMurray going up in flames, it just took me right back to Miller's Reach and the Sockeye Fire last year.
The 1996 Miller's Reach fire in the Mat-Su was the most destructive in state history. Gamble, then the Big Lake fire chief, remembers it vividly. His department now is on full alert. Gamble says fire crews are responding to any local reports of smoke and checking to make sure anyone burning brush has a burn permit and is abiding by its limits.
And we're out there not just waiting for calls to come to us, but we're patrolling and trying to get ahead of the fires to keep them from getting out of control.
Much of Alaska is experiencing conditions similar to those that preceded the Fort McMurray fire. It's been a dry spring following a low snow winter, and now temperatures are much higher than normal.
We're going to see temperatures this weekend close to 80 degrees, and if a wind accompanies that or something, we'll certainly have the conditions that'll promote a large wildland fire.
Tom Kurth is the fire program manager for the Alaska Division of Forestry based in Fairbanks. Among the communities at risk, he says, are those in the boreal forest of the interior, the Mat-Su, and Anchorage. Kurth's eyes are also on the Kenai Peninsula, where he says there's plenty of fuel for a wildfire.
A lot of beetle-killed spruce now is down, and instead of heavy forested lands that we used to have, now there's a lot of grassland out there that is really a very good fire carrier.
As Kurth prepares for the firefighting season, he's lining up assets to help with a large-scale evacuation, and hoping one won't be necessary. Nationally, the federal government spends about $500 million a year to make a few million acres less fire-prone by thinning trees, removing underbrush, and building fire breaks. In Alaska, a few thousand acres have been treated in about 5 years. Kurth says it's slow work and there's fierce competition for grants to fund it. Instead, much of the prevention effort is trained on you, the public. Anchorage Fire Department Forester John C. says he takes every opportunity to educate homeowners, particularly in the most fire-prone areas of the city, like the Hillside and Eagle River.
The message there is you chose to live in the wildland urban interface, so it's up to you to provide for your structure and your family's safety.
This week, C has been responding to a flood of requests for home inspections.
We see lots of things like wood piles under decks. We see snow machines right next to homes, dead grass, leaves that haven't been raked away. A number of homes still have wooden shake roofs.
Like fire personnel around the state, C advises homeowners to clear a defensible space around their homes. He says a little bit of effort can make a home much more resistant to wildfire. For APRN, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline and its operations today and into the future.
Alaska's tobacco quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins lead to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechmiut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, food trucks. Lunchtime options in downtown Anchorage have long been dominated by traditional brick-and-mortar restaurants. But now, hungry downtown diners will have some new options near the Park Strip at a space that's been converted into a food truck forum for the newly minted K Street Eats. APRN's Josh Edge checked out the trucks and, of course, the food.
I'm going to have the chimichurri steak tacos, please.
Awesome. What kind of salsa would you like to do that? We get a little side of a...
Blythe Campbell is one of the first customers on the inaugural day of K Street Eats, and she's chosen tacos from the food truck Tasty Traveler. The truck is a member of the Mobile Junction, angling to be a new lunchtime hangout in downtown Anchorage. The space was a makeshift overflow parking lot, but has since been covered with a large canopy tent, picnic tables, and, of course, food trucks, adorned with colorful handwritten signs with the day's menu. Darren Hike is the owner, operator, and organizer of K Street Eats.
Today we got some cupcakes, some hot sauces, hot sauce truck that has all sorts of stuff, some tacos, some pour-over coffee, some waffles. That's what I'm having today for lunch, by the way.
The space can accommodate up to 15 food trucks and carts, and Darren says the vendor lineup will change daily. He has been organizing food truck carnivals in Anchorage for about 4 years, and he says business is booming.
Some of these trucks are actually trucks that were at the beginning. That blue one right there used to be Urban Bamboo. That white and blue one right there used to be Tears from Heaven. It was a cupcake truck. You know, it's just kind of weird to see that go down in the 4 years. But there's been 50 businesses I've had on record so far, and I already know of at least 25 more that are opening this year.
And he says most of those new ones are opening specifically to come to K Street Eats. I venture back over to the Tasty Traveler, where Blythe Campbell is waiting for her tacos. She works downtown for the Nana Regional Corporation and is excited for the new lunch options, especially as Anchorage warms up.
Now that it's a little springier, you know, we get out and sometimes we'll walk to New Sagaya or we'll walk downtown, but most of the time you just get in your car. And so this is really fun to have the food trucks so close by.
Blythe gets her food and walks back to her office to eat, but I get a glimpse of her chimichurri steak tacos, and they look delicious, so I order a couple of my own. Jim Atkinson, his co-owner, and sous chef are maneuvering the tight confines of the truck in the narrow walkway lined with sinks, counters, cutting boards, and cooktops.
You definitely got to know the people around you and make sure they're okay with you leaning on them or touching you or you bumping them out of the way, so it's definitely very personal.
Jim walks me through the makings of his chimichurri taco.
We grill the steak to order, and it's going to be served on top of a little guacamole, sweet cabbage slaw, and then we slice the steak, layer it on top of that with pico de gallo cotija cheese and a little more of the chimichurri.
Once the tacos are all put together, I head outside to chow down on my meal, complete with homemade chips and salsa. I sit down at a picnic table with Ryan Deal. He's a fellow taco truck customer and works for the Alaska Railroad downtown. He opted for the Tasty Traveler's Tyrito.
It's very refreshing, kind of a nice curry blend and meat, and it's excellent.
But would he order it again?
I gotta try one of everything first, but yeah, I would have it again.
That's good news for Jim Atkinson, Tasty Traveler's owner. Prior to his days in the mobile kitchen, Jim spent his time cooking at successful downtown staples like Orso's, Glacier Brewhouse, and Saks Cafe. But he says food trucks offer a perk seldom found in traditional kitchens.
You get to meet your customers that are coming to the food truck or in a restaurant. You're hidden behind walls, and this way you can just really talk to people and tell them about what you're preparing and, you know, just get more of a social interaction.
It's a concept I certainly appreciate as I complete my gastronomic quest with one final social interaction.
I guess just to finish off here, I gotta try the chocolate bacon cupcake.
Right. Chocolate bacon?
Yes, please.
For AK, I'm Josh Edge.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we're hearing from Palmer and Fina Sagunik. The husband and wife live in Chektulik.
We have 4 children, and we got about 15 grandchildren, plus 1 great, and we live here, and this is our home.
A lot of people that come from another region say this is a harsh lifestyle, and because of the environment, because of what's available here. But as children, we never looked looked at it that way. I mean, everybody has so much memories from childhood. There was no cars, no radios, electricity, television. And we were, some would say, we were free roaming. We lived a subsistence lifestyle in where we could live off the land year round. In the summer, I grew up barefoot. We were in fish camps. We weren't here in the community. We were upriver and putting away fish and subsisting all summer. We walked out in the tundra a lot over the years. Cold and clear, and you can hear the crunch of your steps. And it didn't melt till June.
We won't have this type of the type of weather we grew up with before.
Lakes that once held water, the water drained out.
Permafrost melted. Ground just hanging, you know, where they used to have permafrost. Mm-hmm. Boy, that was weird to see.
That berm is all sand. It'll take one or two big waves to wash it off. So it's cosmetics, if you will, to help people to feel they're safer. It's not making us safer.
But we have to think of the future. Our kids, we don't know what they'll do. Mm-hmm. Our grandkids, we don't know what they'll do.
Palmer and Fina Sagunik live in Shaktulik. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Josh Edge and Isaac Kestenbaum. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found online at alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media or follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman and Rasha McChesney in Juneau, Josh Edge and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, and Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Rachel Waldholz. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
What can a tiny piece of dust do to you? It can stop you in your tracks. Studies show exposure to dust pollution can cause tightness in your chest, wheezing, and shortness of breath, even if you're healthy. When you're on an unpaved road, drive slowly, especially when operating an ATV. When hauling dirt, cover it up. Do your part, avoid dust, and clear the air. We'll all breathe easier. This message sponsored by Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.